Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Just a quick invitation for those of you who have not yet joined Bulwark Plus. Membership in Bulwark Plus gives you access to a number of things, including my morning newsletter, Morning Shots, a Triad by JVL, other podcasts like The Next Level and The Secret Podcast, and of course, our Bulwark Plus exclusive live streams. Which we do on a weekly basis. And this is membership. This is a way to be part of this community of sane people in this particular era. You know, I know that a lot of people were wondering, well, what happens after Donald Trump leaves? Well, the answer is the fight goes on. If there's any doubt, just look at the headlines today where the Republican Party is trying to decide, what do we do with Marjorie Taylor Greene and Liz Cheney? And guess who is the more controversial figure in that party? So going forward, this is going to be a long-term struggle, and we're here for it. We are going to, you know, stick around for as long as it takes, and we really appreciate all of your support, all of you that have signed up for Bulwark Plus. And here's a special offer. I mentioned it a couple of times that if you go to is it the Bulwark, thebulwark.com/Charlie, you can get a 30-day free trial membership. If you just sign up, you can just see what you perhaps have been missing, and to be part of this particular community, we would really appreciate it. And once again, you know, thank you so much for all of you who have been listening to this podcast. And I think I mentioned it yesterday with Aaron Ryan that we had crossed 32 million total downloads and 2.6 million just in the last month. And I really appreciate that. And I certainly do not take that for granted. And I know that Bill Kristol doesn't take it for granted as well. By the way, did you hear we name checked you yesterday, Bill?
I didn't hear that. Congratulations, first of all, on the 2.6 million is really a huge number. But I do want to just say a word about Bulwark Plus. And I didn't know you were going to make this pitch, so this wasn't coordinated. But Jonathan's midday newsletter is excellent. It's very quirky, Jonathan Lastlike, but very interesting and provocative. And there's always some article he links to that in some place I don't know about, usually, that I read. So, and then his own thoughts are always so interesting. And your newsletter, which I get in my inbox, what, about 9:30 each morning, mm-hmm. Eastern time, is just fantastic. I mean, I don't know how you actually get to such a comprehensive survey of what's important each morning, but also, you know, witty comments about it and telling comments about it. So the two of those are well worth the Bulwark Plus contribution. And plus, it's great to have youth people who contribute as part of the effort here. So I'm very bullish on Bulwark Plus and bullish on this podcast. And usually you have better guests than today with me. But so what did you and Aaron say yesterday?
Well, I name checked you because I was commenting on the fact that we had 2.6 million downloads, which would normally be the biggest month ever, with the exception of the Billy Kristol, Bill Kristol month. Because remember, a couple of months ago, we had a podcast where we ran some audio of Billy Kristol and you. Yeah. And I think a lot of people must have thought that the podcast guest was Billy Kristol, maybe, because we had about six times.
Take down your colleague there, undercut his confidence and morale, but that's okay. I'll just kind of soldier on here, you know, the second level.
We have this spike, though. It's this, like, everything's going along, and then there is this one episode that is about six times as many people downloaded, and my only explanation is that it was the Billy Kristol vibe there. I don't know. So
It's possible that Billy Kristol has got a few more fans than I do. I'm doubtful about that, but I guess anything's possible in this day and age, right?
Anything is possible. Okay. So hey, thanks for the kind words about the newsletter. So one of the things I talk about in the newsletter is Liz Cheney and the future of the Republican Party. This is really one of those extraordinary days where everything feels crystallized. The House Republicans have got to decide, what do you do with a problem like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Liz Cheney? And apparently they couldn't come to a decision on whether to strip the, you know, bigoted lunatic QAnon conspiracy theorist Greene of her committee assignment last night. So they've kind of punted on that. And we don't know what's going to happen, because we know that the Jim Jordan, Matt Gaetz wing of the Republican Party wants to purge Liz Cheney. I mean, think about it at the end of the day. If they're not able to do anything substantive about Marjorie Taylor Greene, they're okay with her, but we got to get rid of Liz Cheney. I mean, what would that say about the Republican Party, or maybe just say again about the Republican Party?
No, obviously today will be an interesting day. I guess the House Republicans meet late this afternoon. But either way, as you say in the newsletter, Marjorie Taylor Greene's not going away. Maybe McCarthy will remove her from one of her two committees, but maybe the Democrats will still insist on a vote about whether she should be on any committees at all. But she's a major figure in the party. It's been clear that McCarthy met with her privately last night and was just unwilling, apparently, to confront her and to really say, I'm sorry, you're off a committee here. This is unacceptable. Then the steering committee met last night, which is the leadership. They didn't come to a conclusion. So they're desperately trying to find a middle ground, if you can believe it, between Marjorie Taylor Greene on the one hand and sanity on the other. So the best case for the House Republicans is that they're somewhere in between craziness and responsibility, but probably tilting towards craziness, because Liz Cheney, who is a very conservative Republican, I know Liz well, I knew Liz well, I worked with her closely, we've drifted apart a little in the last 3 to 4 years, because she's been pro-Trump. I mean, she's, of course, better than Trump, and she knows all of Trump's faults, but she supported him in 2016, she supported him in 2020 for re-election, she voted against impeaching him at the beginning of 2020, she supported some of the things he did that really shouldn't have been supported, honestly, because she felt she had to, and she was number three in the leadership. January 6th was too much. She made a very powerful statement, and to her credit, has stuck to that and voted for impeachment a week later, even though it was there only 10 Republicans who did so. And most of the, I admire all 10 of those, incidentally, and I think they all deserve support. But most of those, you might say, were more moderate Republicans who you might have expected to be discomforted with Trump, whereas Liz Cheney is a conservative Republican and a member of the leadership. McCarthy's been not supportive of her, I would say, I respect Liz Cheney, but, you know, she should have consulted with me first, and the way she said it wasn't so good. And now I guess he's going to allow, I don't know if he has a choice, a debate about her status as the number three Republican in the House, the conference chair, and maybe there'll actually be a vote. And that will be an interesting, but I mean, it'll be an interesting glimpse into the window into where the House Republicans are, but it's a glimpse already of such a level of craziness that it's not going to, she might win a vote by 30 votes. Mm-hmm. She might lose a vote by 30 votes. It might be inconclusive, but the big story is the House Republicans really are, and they're the closest to the public. Obviously they're elected every 2 years. That is not a party that could even pretend to govern.
No, and they're not interested in it. So I want to stick with this point that you just made here, because, you know, every once in a while I hear people talk about, you know, what is the future of moderate Republicans in the party? Look, this is the thing about Liz Cheney, and you said it, but I have some of the numbers here on this. She is not a moderate. She's not a rhino. She's not a squish. She was a loyal Trump supporter, and she supported the entire conservative agenda, the quote unquote conservative agenda, right down the line. In fact, you know, the guys from 538 have been tracking all of this, and so over Trump's presidency, she voted with Trump 94% of the time. In his first 2 years, she voted with Trump 96% of the time. Now, occasionally, obviously, she might have not have voted with him on some spending bills, but she didn't just vote to support Trump's policies. I mean, she voted down the line on regulation. She voted on trade. Pretty much everything Donald Trump wanted her to do, she did. And, you know, she lined up to support Trump again up until January 6th. Remember back in February 2019, we thought it was a red line, but she voted to uphold Trump's emergency order on funding the Mexican border wall. That was a real loyalty litmus test. We were very disappointed in her. July 2019, she voted against a resolution condemning Trump for his racist comments about 4 Democratic congresswomen. She voted against the attempts to impeach him over Ukraine again and again. So she was one of the people who had totally bought into all of these policy things, all of the personal stuff, and hyper loyal, reliable foot soldier until she wasn't. And then the loyalty counted for nothing. This is the thing about the Trump world. You know, when she called out Trump, none of those votes mattered. None of the policy issues or the bills or the items on the agenda counted anymore. So, you know, obviously, you know, she's the one who has to be primaried. I mean, even if she survives today, she'll be primary. But I think this is what's revealing about it is, you know, remember how often we've been told, oh, Bill, Charlie, don't pay attention to what he tweets. Look at his policies. Look at what he's done. But what it comes down to, it's always Trump all along, right? I mean, you know, forget the trade, you know, taxes, healthcare, abortion, regulations, judges. There's only Trump. Because here's the bottom line. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene supports Trump, and Liz Cheney doesn't go along 100%. And that's all that counts right now. Then that explains what's happening today.
Right. And look at the Senate, which has been a little better. I mean, the senators didn't vote to overturn the election results the way the House Republicans, a large majority, did. But Trump is now out of office. There are no policies left to defend. There's no weakening of Trump if you vote to convict him of the impeachment in the Senate next week. There's no undoing of whatever of the tax rates. There's no removing of the judges, right? So we're just beyond all the policy stuff. We have a pure vote on whether he should be held accountable for what happened on January 6th, for his propagation of what you've called the deep lie. I like that phrase, the big lie or the deep lie, and the effects it had on the country and on the people, obviously, who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, his silence on the afternoon of January 6th, when he's the president of the United States and did nothing to come to the rescue of the United States Capitol and the people in it. All of that can be condemned. You don't give up. You know, Amy Coney Barrett does not leave the Supreme Court.
Right.
If you're a senator and you vote to convict Trump, the tax rates don't go back to what they were in 2016. The Biden administration is neither stronger nor weaker the next day as a result, honestly. I'd say actually a little weaker because Republicans would have more credibility in opposing the Biden administration. But they still apparently, we don't know for sure, won't vote based on that earlier vote. 5 of the 50 Republican senators, 10%, look like they're really going to vote to convict. What's the reason for that? I mean,
there's no excuse. Right.
That is fear, I guess. It's a couple of things. Some of them agree with Trump. Some of them, don't want to repudiate Trump, as they want to be part of a party which has a strong Trumpist element. They might prefer that Trump personally step aside a bit. They might prefer that a couple of the really fringy parts of the element be pushed away, but they want that kind of party. Others are just afraid to take it on or don't think it's worth it or whatever calculation they're making. But to that vote next week, if it is next week or the week after, on conviction is extremely revealing for the reasons you were saying, that it has nothing to do with any policy or any policy at all or hurting the Republicans in an election. Maybe they could have said in the summer of 2020, we can't weaken our team here. And then it was, we can't weaken the Georgia candidates for January 5th. That is all gone.
The excuses are gone.
Yeah. Right.
So let's talk about the impeachment trial, because we got the legal brief yesterday. And because I'm kind of a geek, I read through through them, and I don't know about you, but the contrast was pretty dramatic. I mean, you put them side by side, and I'm not just making fun of the Trump defense, which starts off by misspelling the United States Senate and then misquotes the Constitution. I mean, what a lightweight work it was. But I really have to say that I thought the House Democrats did a masterful job, both in describing the law, but also in just laying out Donald Trump's misconduct here, just laying it out and putting it in context.
Yeah, I agree. People should read it. It's not that long. The whole thing is maybe 50 pages, but you can skim a couple of parts of it where they deal with the constitutional arguments about not convicting someone once he's out of office, which are, I think, bad arguments by the Trump people, and they knock those down. But on the substance, I give them credit for this, and this is something we urged, actually, in the Bulwark several times. Jeff Toulis and I had a piece on this, on Trump's dereliction of duty on January 6th. They broadened, in a way, the original article of impeachment, or at least they broadened, it's probably not quite right, but they didn't narrow it in the sense of making it just about what Trump said at noon on January 6th.
It's really important.
Days before. They laid out the pattern of conduct from November 3rd on, and really before November 3rd, the big lie about the election, the attempts privately and publicly within the federal government and in dealing with state government officials and in rallying public mobs to overturn the election, culminating in the event of January 6th, and then culminating in his silence during the events of January 6th. And even what he said late in the afternoon of January 6th, when he said they were, was it good people? I can't remember anymore. They were, he praised them. And
We love you.
Yeah, I love you. So, yeah, that's right. They kill Officer Nicknick, and then he loves them. So, I guess he didn't die until the next morning. But, I mean, they create an unbelievable amount of violence and damage.
Yeah, police officer died. 5 people, including a Capitol police officer, died.
Trump sort of said anything about that? Or, has he kind of apologized? I want to come back to that in a second. But anyway, the manager's brief in the impeachment case it does capture the gravity of the situation and the breadth of Trump's attempted usurpation. A friend of mine said this to me about 10 days ago that, you know, everyone's talking about insurrection, which is true. But really, if you look back at the history of kind of people writing about democracy, what are they worried about? They're worried about a usurpation of power. I think Lincoln uses that term in the Lyceum speech. Trump was trying to usurp power. He was trying to stay in power and prevent Biden from legitimately taking his turn in the presidency, since he had won the vote for the presidency in the Electoral College. And so the insurrection was in the service of a usurpation. And I think the House, I don't think the House refuses the term usurpation, but it lays that out. It lays that out quite well.
No, and I think this was really important because it is that whole big lie, deep lie, beginning in November, that if the president had not lied about the election, if he had not propagated the lie, if he had not spread the lie, if he had not insisted that other Republicans go along with the lie, none of this would have happened. And there's a great paragraph right there in the House brief. None of this would have happened without the president. The president could have immediately and forcefully intervened to stop the violence on the day of January 6th. He did not. There has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States to fulfill his office. Okay, so, you know, and you also talked about his dereliction of duty that day. I think this is what is important, is to paint the entire picture. And we've gotten a lot of reports that they're planning on making a very, very emotionally compelling video presentation to the Senate, because, you know, there's been some remarkable work by folks who've put together the entire story of all of this. And I actually do think it's going to be interesting. Look, in the end, I think Republicans are going to weasel out by hiding behind the bogus constitutional argument here. But it is interesting that I'll be interesting to see whether anybody actually tries to substantively defend Donald Trump. You know, defend his conduct.
That will be interesting. And I come back to, I mentioned this in passing, so let me just make this point that you and I have both made this before, but it's worth emphasizing, I think. Let's just say they meant well. I mean, whether it's Trump or Marjorie Taylor Greene or Kevin McCarthy, who said after the election, 3 days after, I think on November 5th or 6th, I think it was, on Fox, something, Trump won the election. He didn't say, he didn't say, let the legal process go forward, which was kind of the moderate, you know, excusing of Trump's not conceding position. Trump won the election. We all need to, act or something.
Speak
like
up.
That.
Don't be quiet about this.
Yeah, it was even stronger, maybe. But so he's part of this too. Has any of them said, as I think any decent person would say in a similar circumstance, you know what? I didn't mean, of course, for people to storm the Capitol. I meant, you know, let's have a legal process. I mean, it can reinterpret their own words. And I'm very sorry if anyone misunderstood me, and I apologize for the terrible things that happened, for if I inadvertently contributed to them. Now, I don't think in all these cases it was so inadvertent, but that would be at least the minimal thing one would do. I was trying to think of myself or you or anyone, you know, in a situation where you might have said something maybe a little bit heated in some moment, some people, you know, do something really pretty bad as a result, not as a result of what one says, but in accordance, let's just say, with what one says. One feels terrible, right? You say, that's not what I meant. And I really, I'm sorry. And I regret that. I'm going to be more careful in the future. None of them has said that. They all went along, almost all of them, with the bogus claim of the steal. Some of them finally, 3 weeks, 6 weeks later, oh no, I guess it looks like it's now legitimate, you know. But no reprimand of Trump, no acceptance of their own responsibility of going along with it, either by echoing it or even magnifying it, or at least being silent about it. McConnell, I mean, even Mitch McConnell, who's behaved a little bit better in the last few weeks, until the Georgia runoff in January 5th, I mean, it was all, we got to keep quiet because we have to keep the coalition together. Think of that. You're justifying poisoning the American democratic system because you think it gives you a better chance of holding two Senate seats in a runoff. I mean, it's so irresponsible. I'm glad they didn't hold the seats, but it's a perfect punishment, you might say, but not enough punishment, really, because they really are, so many of them are complicit in this. That's not just, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, I'm happy she's going to be disciplined, but in a certain way, she's become a scapegoat. You know, they discipline her and they pretend she's the problem. She's not the problem. Donald Trump's the problem.
Well, and Donald Trump and all the Republicans that went along with him.
Word for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, remember we had that that article in the Bulwark about Ron Johnson calling some guy in Brown County and said, of course, I know that Biden won the election, but I can't say that because right. That would be political suicide. So all of these Republicans. So Mitch McConnell's latest version, though, is, and maybe he's telling the truth, I mean, that he was duped by Jared Kushner and others who called him up and say, look, just give him some time, give the president some time. He's going to concede, so you don't have to immediately acknowledge Biden's victory. And McConnell went along with that, at least until the electoral votes were cast. But that was a crucial period of time where the deep lie penetrated, you know, both the media ecosystem and the grassroots of the Republican Party and elected officials. But you would think that at some point, Mitch McConnell would come out and say, "Yeah, I was misled." You know, I regret this, but then of course, that's admitting to quite a bit, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, too much, I guess. And so they're not saying that. And again, I'm happy if they discipline Marjorie Taylor Greene, but I mean, she wouldn't be in Congress. She wouldn't be at all famous if Trump hadn't embraced, legitimized, and excused all the crazy conspiracy theories, all the lying, and then personally, of course, embraced her when she won the primary, as did, incidentally, Kevin McCarthy and the NRCC. The National Republican Congressional Committee could have said no funding for Marjorie Taylor Greene. She won right. The primary. She's got the R beside her name, unfortunately, in the 14th District Congressional District of Georgia, but we're not supporting her. That's happened occasionally in rare cases. No, they were fine with her. Not only were they fine with her, they designated her a young gun, which is their little, you know, standing, which signals donors, yes, you should help this person. She's a sort of she has a winnable race, and it's important to us that she wins the race. She wins the race. She screams and yells in a totally irresponsible way for 2.5 months. She's sworn in. January 6th happens. And no one says anything, no one does anything, really, until the Democrats threaten to bring it to the floor to kick her off the committee. And then Kevin McCarthy sort of kicks into a very limited action to try to minimize the damage. So it's so irresponsible. And again, none of them, who's the biggest liar and the biggest conspiracy theorist peddler in American politics? Not Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's Donald Trump.
It is Donald Trump. So, you know, we talk about the crazy and the crazy conspiracy theories, and I just want to stop there for a moment because, you know, that word can be overused because it really strikes me reading the Axios account. You read Jonathan Swan's Axios account of some of these screaming matches right. that they had in the Oval Office, or Mike Lindell, my pillow guy, going on was it Newsmax yesterday? That and I mean this advisedly. These people are crazy. I mean, there is a level of insanity here that is like, we're not talking about eccentric. We're not talking about, well, you know, pushing the envelope. I mean, these people are nuts. And the president of the United States was listening to them. Here's a man sitting in the Oval Office with people who clearly have no idea what they're talking about, making stories up, insane conspiracy theories, proposing nutty ideas. And the president of the United States, the commander in chief of our military, the man who still had the nuclear codes at that time, is listening to them, encouraging them, and indulging them. I mean, so in retrospect, you got to be feeling when you said, I'm alarmed. It's like, wow, there was every reason to be alarmed. I mean, just how bizarre this was. I think historians are going to have a hard time understanding. They're going to look at this and go, okay, you people out there, did you understand that your president was doing this kind of stuff?
Well, but what they could have, should have understood is that their president, our president, was publicly encouraging behavior, which did culminate in January 6th.
Yeah. So
the reporting's great, and it's interesting to read. And I think I was right to be alarmed about aspects of what was happening in the Defense Department and what Trump was trying to do with the Justice Department and so forth. But on the public record, there's no excuse, and you've made this point many times, for having supported him for re-election or having excused his behavior after the election. Again, a little different in 20, if you're voting for policies you agree with, if you're even justifying McConnell jamming Justice Barrett through in that last week before the election. Those are all, you know, I think I'm not happy about those, but there's kind of a rationale for swallowing hard and going along. No rationale for justifying, for keeping silent in light of his public attacks on the legitimacy of our democratic elections and his public demagoguery and embracing of crazy conspiracies about the election. I mean, leave aside QAnon stuff, which he also embraced and retweeted all kinds of craziness about SEAL teams being secretly killed by army, you know, soldiers to keep things quiet and all kinds of terrible stuff, really. But on the actual election theft, which is the big lie, the deep lie, a lot of people echoing it and a lot of people being silent about it.
So one of the more interesting developments, I think, is the fact that the voting machine companies are coming out with these big lawsuits, which has succeeded in doing something that nobody else had succeeded in doing, which is getting some of the crazy media folks on the right wing to back off big time. In case people haven't seen this 2-minute clip of Mike Lindell, the pillow guy, going on Newsmax, which of course had been a conduit for him, very friendly environment. And he comes on and he's supposed to talk about cancel culture and he starts ranting and raving and they have to shut him down. And they're actually one of the male anchors is reading. You can tell kind of this legal thing, like there's no proof whatsoever. They don't know the Dominion did anything wrong and blah, blah, blah. And Lindell is just, you know, yelling and spouting and keeps going on. And eventually the Newsmax anchor just walks off the set. He's like, I don't want to be part of this. I don't want to be involved in this. But it is amazing how billion-dollar lawsuits can focus the mind. And so, you know, when the story is all written, so maybe it won't be the Senate. Maybe it won't be the criminal justice system. Maybe it will be civil lawsuits that bring down Rudy Giuliani and some of these serial liars.
And corporate actions of different kinds and citizen actions of different kinds, I think, can make a real difference. I mean, why do we have to have Newsmax on our cable packages? Couldn't we push Verizon or Comcast or whoever to let us pick the channels we want and not subsidize those channels? They get paid, you know, a certain amount to be kept, to be carried. And if fewer of us want those networks and the Super Two or Fox, of course, they would get less in the way of revenues. Advertisers is a more obvious case. And, you know, shareholders can tell corporations, if they're public corporations, we don't want you to advertise on these networks or on these shows. And people can, of course, as consumers, not buy MyPillow pillows and so forth. So I think there's a lot of we need to think more broadly about strengthening our country and our political system through civil society and through not simply through government and hoping that the Senate Republicans will do the right thing. And I think the more you think about it, social media, similarly, you can have reforms in the way social media is regulated and the incentive structure that might create a healthier situation. So we need to think more broadly about going forward about we can't just treat ourselves as defenseless. Well, what can we do?
Right.
Like Fox News just exists, and there's no governing structure. There's no board of directors. There's no ability to pressure advertisers or cable companies or individuals who contribute to it. Not pressure them in a bad way, but make clear that they're part of something that really is doing damage to the country. I think we need to think more broadly in ways that are consistent, obviously, with I think basic civility, freedom of speech, respecting other people's rights, about what we can do to maintain these guardrails. We can't just hope that a bunch of politicians in Washington do it for us.
Oh, I know, I agree. And I don't want the politicians in Washington to do it for us. But I think this whole idea of the free riders, you know, the Newsmaxes or even Fox News being on the cable bill, that you pay for a cable package, you don't necessarily choose them. And those carriage fees are immensely important for these folks. So that's an area of vulnerability. I also think that, you know, conservatives in particular ought to be stepping up and saying, remember, these social media sites are private companies, and we need to resist any effort by the government to compel them either to say something or not say something. That was amazing. You see the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, is actually proposing legislation that would fine any social media company $100,000 a day if they deplatformed anyone running for office in Florida during a campaign. In other words, they would use government power to force Twitter to carry someone that they as a private company did not choose to carry. And yet conservatives are like, yes, absolutely. Government power forcing private businesses to do stuff. We're in it.
Yeah, and it's not as if they're deplatforming a lot of candidates. They're not. But in the exceptional case of a true conspiracy theorist who's inciting violence, they don't have the right to say, no, I'm sorry, we're not going to be used for that. That's ridiculous.
So you know what took place a year ago today? Nope. The Iowa caucuses.
Is that right?
Think back on how, you know, things change. I mean, this is one of the things to keep in mind. The things move very, very quickly. How different the world was. Bernie Sanders, I think, got the most votes in the caucus, although I've now forgotten how it actually works. Pete Buttigieg, didn't he end up winning the most delegates?
He basically got a tiny bit more in the way of delegates, I think, yeah.
Yeah, think what's happening in 1 year. Okay, so let's talk about this. There's an interesting back and forth about the way Joe Biden has handled his first. I was going to say, I have to look at this now. Do you realize that he's been president for 2 weeks?
It's crazy, isn't that amazing? Yeah, yeah.
Actually, I heard Jen Psaki yesterday was talking about. Well, in our first 10 weeks, we have done. And goes, oh wait. That was a Freudian slip. In our first 10 days, we have done. It's been 2 weeks, and you know, I was listening to MSNBC, and there were people, you know, wringing their hands about why he hasn't moved more quickly on this issue or that issue. Like, people, give it some time, really. But you know, there is a lot of chatter on the right saying that hey, he ran as this bipartisan unifier, and he's moving hard left. He is pushing through his big spending bill without bipartisan majority. Your thoughts on this? Whether or not, I mean, how Biden is handling that whole issue of the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. He wanted to have Republican support, obviously not going to get Republican support. So they're going to push it through on a party line vote, it appears.
Yeah, it looks that way. Before getting to that, I do have a thought or two about that. I would just say your general point about how much things have changed in the year, the pandemic obviously wasn't on our front and center in our minds, though it, I guess, existed already in China. In early February of course it existed in early February 2020, and as you say, it looked like Biden was finished. Things can change a lot, and that's a good lesson going forward, I guess. I mean, we shouldn't be too fatalistic about anything, whether it's the Republican Party or individuals, I guess, even in the party, or policies, or the country, or 40 million people believing crazy conspiracy theories. These things can break. I mean, the fever can break, and things can fade away almost as quickly as they rose up. It doesn't mean they haven't done a huge amount of damage, and it doesn't mean one should complacently expect it all to fade away.
Right.
It fades away more if you take it on, right? If you denounce it, if you explain the truth. But anyway, that is, I think,
you had a tweet on this the other day where you're pointing out that
this is correct what I said, but I haven't really looked at the back and researched and reminded myself exactly of all the twists and turns. But 1924, if I'm not mistaken, that was the 104 ballot Democratic convention, which ended up nominating some Wall Street lawyer, what was his name, Davis, I think, who lost badly. But they refused to condemn the Ku Klux Klan, which was then reascendant in its kind of second wave, I suppose. That was the Democratic Party, which had a huge number of Southern delegates, but also in Northern states like Indiana, the Klan was very powerful. So they refused to condemn the Klan. In 28, the Democratic Party nominated the first Catholic nominee for president, Hal Smith, the governor of New York. And in 1932, it nominated Franklin Roosevelt, and then dominated American politics, obviously, for the next, really, 40 years, I'd say. So, almost. So, that's, things can change quickly. And I suppose if we had been there in 24, we would have said, can you believe it? They can't even condemn the Ku Klux Klan. And maybe one would have said by 32, you know what, that party's kind of pulled itself together and we wouldn't have agreed with it all, but a respectable, chance of getting us out of the depression and dealing with the problem. So,
I think that's a really good point, because in 1924, the Democrats viewed the KKK the way Republicans view QAnon, which is that it's an important constituency. Yes, they're crazy, but we can't alienate them because we need those votes. And so you figure that this is a party pretty much linked to this. But 4 years later, they nominate a Roman Catholic. And I mean, really, things do change and they are unpredictable. So that's worth doing. So let's go back. What do you think about Biden?
We had a good piece by Stan Voiger. There were ways that stimulus package or economic relief package could have been better structured, I think. I might have even gone just for the vaccine and COVID stuff separately and get that through in a super emergency way and tell Republicans, you got to vote for this at least, because I think the vaccine and the testing is so important to our well-being. Having said all that, I guess I don't have a detailed view of whether the 1.9 is better trillion is better than the 600 billion, but I also don't think it's worth having a heart attack about, honestly. If they spend too much money in the 1.9 trillion, They'll probably claw it back from the wealthy with a tax increase anyway in 2 years. The Republican position is a little inconsistent. We shouldn't give this much money to the wealthy. And then the Democrats say, okay, fine. You know, look, it's safer just to give everyone money now. Let's just prevent, you know, businesses from going out of business. Let's make sure we're flooding the system basically with money, and with money also for the vaccines and for schools. And if, you know, later on we can come back to this in 2 years. Republicans, oh my God, you can't raise taxes on people making more than $1 million in 2 years. So there's a funny kind of inconsistency there. But I would err on the side of going big. You can always, you know, pay that down later. If you go too small, and if businesses do go out of business, and if these variants, which I've now talked to a couple of public health professionals, and they are pretty worried about these variant strains and their greater contagion and possibly being somewhat more resistant to the vaccines, hopefully, and thank God not, it seems like the vaccines work on them for now, but the more contagion you get, obviously, the more challenge you get, the more possibility of other variants, that being hyper urgent about dealing with the thing as well as we can, as quickly as we can, I think makes a lot of sense. And if the price for that is wasting some money, we should do so. And I am worried about where we end up if we kind of go slow. I think the Republican senators who made the counteroffer are acting in good faith. And I think Biden acted in good faith by meeting with them for 2 hours in the Oval Office. But they can't guarantee their votes for some compromise in between. They can't get any other Republican votes. And, I do think on this one, the Democrats are going to end up passing something without much Republican support. Republicans will complain, and then everyone will just judge on whether it works or not.
Right. And that ultimately is going to be the way people look at it. And I think that one of the lessons is that most political parties do not pay a price for, that you don't get any points for being bipartisan if you don't actually get the job done. One of the things that has actually helped me understand, I think, what's the thinking in the White House right now is Barack Obama's book, where he goes into great detail of all of the efforts, which, of course, we didn't give much attention to at the time when we didn't appreciate it much at the time, but that he really, really, really wanted to get Republican support for healthcare and for the stimulus package. And he talks about all the things they did to get Olympia Snow on board, you know, the number of meetings and dinners and lunches. And they promised her, I think at one point, Obama said, look, if you just give her Air Force One for her own personal use. And they just kept trying to get, you know, one Republican after another, and they negotiated with them, and they went back and forth for months. And then eventually there was a meeting where I can't remember which Republican it was. And they said, you're really not ever going to vote for this bill, are you? And the guy goes, nah, probably not. So it strikes me that it's in the back of Biden's mind. He wanted to do it, but he doesn't want to get caught up in what happened with Obama, spending all of that time, all of, you know, going after, you know, remember all the, you know, the Cornhusker kickback and all of the other stuff that went on. You have to do it. You have to do it fast. So I'm thinking that whole experience really is informing what's going on right now.
No, I think very much so. And I would just say, in addition, so that was the Obamacare experience, but the stimulus experience for Obama, or the economic relief, as soon as he came in, and people do forget the bottom was falling out of the economy, yeah, and they were terrified that you could have a genuine, full-scale Great Depression. And they jammed through, without making much in the way of concessions to Republicans, the original bailout, you know, $800 billion or whatever it was, seemed like a huge number at the time, stimulus package. And they have all decided, and I don't know if they're right or not, some of the economists have decided they should have probably gone out somewhat bigger, that they didn't get anything out of being a little cautious and trying to be a little, quote, responsible looking. And so I think they very much have internalized that lesson too: go bigger rather than smaller. At the time, I remember thinking it was awfully big, and they didn't give Republicans much in the way of a handhold to support it. I was at a dinner with President-elect Obama. This was at George Will's house. It got some attention at the time. The week before inauguration, it was an attempt of that by them to kind of do a little outreach to the kind of conservative columnist types and so forth, magazine types in Washington. And I remember to the one, we each sort of had one chance to really say something substantive, you know, went around the table, kind of the dinners with presidents are not really like normal chit chat dinners somehow. I mean, there was some chit chat, but then it got kind of a little formalistic, you might say, or, and my one contribution was to say that actually, I thought he should put in a lot of construction money for defense and a lot of some defense acquisition that does produce jobs quickly. The Pentagon can spend money quickly. That's one reason we got out of the Depression at the beginning of, in the run up to World War II. And I thought it would attract, frankly, a few people like me who cared a lot mm-hmm. about the drawdown of the military, we'd really, you know, fighting those wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we had depleted a lot of our resources. And he was sort of, well, I'll talk to Bob Gates, but, you know, they're going to do what's right for the defense. But that's sort of a different issue. He wasn't very interested in it, honestly. And maybe he was right. And maybe my thing wouldn't have mattered anyway. But there was a certain attitude of, look, we won. And we've got, what, 59 Democratic senators and a big majority in the House. So we don't have to listen to you guys. So I think they had, unlike, I'm sure this is not quite captured in his book, but they have some responsibility for the,
oh, definitely,
for the, you know, partisanship that took over very, very quickly after his, after the good feelings, after his victory, and after McCain's gracious concession and so forth. But again, the lesson they've learned from all that is, I think, especially when you're in a crisis, go big and don't waste too much time bargaining. And so I think they're going to do that.
Yeah, the only thing that I think would be, and I see that they're considering this, is finding a way to target the money a little bit better, maybe to cap the, you know, cap the, the checks, the relief checks, at a lower income level, because just, you know, spewing a money cannon over the world is not necessarily, I mean, I don't need a check. I didn't lose any jobs. I haven't missed any paychecks. Right. You know, what we need is not just a raw stimulus of the economy. We need it to be targeted in relief, because this is a, as they know well, I mean, this is a very weird recovery. It's very K-shaped. And, you know, to the extent that you focus the money on the people who are really hurting out there, as opposed to, you know, the half of Americans or not who are not hurting. I mean, this is a little bit different. So I would hope that they would target it a little bit more carefully. But other than that, like, you just get it done, because ultimately we're going to look back on this and Joe Biden either got a handle on the coronavirus pandemic, or he did not. He either brought the economy back or he didn't. And nobody's going to care about the sausage making of the legislation. They're just not. It's either you get this done, you succeed, or you do not. And frankly, this, the challenge of the coronavirus is extraordinary. You mentioned the variants out there. I think that the vaccination program has been more complicated than some people believe that it was going to be. We have the mutations, and then there's this whole question of getting kids back to school. I mean, those things are major challenges. I saw you were tweeting about one idea about schools.
Yeah, it's actually happening. It's not just an idea. In Massachusetts, Governor Baker has announced, and I think it's beginning like now, or maybe has begun this mm-hmm. week. I know someone who's involved in one of these firms who's producing these mass tests. They're going to just do mass, what's called pool testing, make it available for free, I think, to every school, certainly to every public school, but I think every school in Massachusetts. The teachers' unions are on board. Basically, they test the teachers and the staff, but then they also, and they vaccinate them. Mm-hmm. That's already happening. But then they test all the kids, and you get 20 kids in a class, you test all 20. It's cheap. These mass tests, they're not quite as fancy as the individual tests. You dump the 20, you know, the test, you know, what do you call mm-hmm. them, Q-tips or whatever they are in a vat. If they're all negative, you know that class is fine. If there's a positive result, then you have to go test them each individually, which you then do quickly, and you keep the kid who's sick home, and you keep masks on and social distancing and so forth. It's just a way to reassure people, it's a way to reassure people, and it's a way to obviously actually monitor the situation and prevent something from getting out of control at some school. Could also work for workplaces, and you could have instant testing in restaurants, and incidentally, you could come in and take a quick test the way when you go now, maybe to a doctor's office or anywhere, a lot of places you get a quick thermometer, you know, read. So that would help a lot until the vaccines really take hold. I think the Biden administration, I would say, I think they are possessed of a sense of urgency if you talk.
Oh, yeah.
But I think they could demonstrate that a little more. I'd be doing a little more, you know, sort of really urgent urging of states and localities to go to this kind of testing regimen, to get the schools open, and then to get the vaccines distributed. And I know they're trying to do this. They're trying to now get those. A big mistake. It's ironic, right? The Trump administration, private sector friendly, didn't want to distribute the vaccines through CVS and Walmart and all these characters. So it was pretty much entirely through governments. And it's been, you know, difficult and cluttered, and they're not using now there are reasons they had, some of them have to be frozen very, you know, to very cold temperatures, but they're not using the places that actually are administering a million vaccines a day, which is, you know, for flu shots, which are basically your supermarket.
And they know how to do it.
And now they're, the Biden administration is going to, it's going to take a few weeks, but they're going to ramp that up. So I think the actual vaccine program is going to get improved and sort of fixed in it. But I think the more urgency they can show on that, the better. And I still worry there's a little bit too much business as usual. Sorry, we're closing at 5 p.m. We're closing, you know, we're not open for the weekend. Now, it's easy for me to say that. I'm not working at these places, and they would have to find people, new employees. And that's, again, but that's what the money was for. That's why some of that money in the stimulus package is for that. It's to pay the extra people you'd need to stay open Saturday and Sunday and to retrain, to get some retired nurses in and, you know, give them the quick training if they need it. And then they can give the shots and monitor people for the 15 minutes afterwards and so forth. So it's still not being treated quite like a kind of World War II, you know, all hands on deck, highest priority thing. It is the key. If that gets fixed, a lot of other things, including the economy, will get fixed.
Yeah, everything falls into place.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories was this story out of a little town in South Carolina that was having some problem because their computers kept crashing. They were trying to, you know, get people vaccinated. And so the mayor had this idea. He figured, you know who does this really well, this sort of logistics? Chick-fil-A. So he goes to the manager of Chick-fil-A and he says, if we were doing a drive-through thing, how would you organize it? And the guy says, well, I would do this, you know, I would do this. And apparently they dropped the wait time from more than an hour to less than 15 minutes because they were using Chick-fil-A, which almost had, you talk about wartime footing, sort of a Dunkirk feel to it, like all hands on deck. We're going to use all the people who are smart about logistics and how to do this stuff, and we're going to get them involved in this.
Yeah, and I mean, the irony again is the Trump administration vaguely pretended to have that attitude for about a month. You know, Kushner was having meetings with MBAs and stuff. They didn't do any of that, and that's the real tragedy. They did a little bit on the vaccine development side. Even there, though, it seems like there are now very promising Johnson & Johnson vaccines and AstraZeneca, is that what it's called, in the UK. They've administered more than a million of those in the UK. And the FDA is still kind of, well, we need to have a double-blind test for, you know, 28 days. I don't mean to minimize that. And obviously we want to be careful and all this. But I do have the feeling there's not quite the sense from the top of, forget it. You know what I mean? We will do the test at the same time, but we'll also start vaccinating. Maybe we'll start vaccinating
right away
the people who, you know, the staff in the schools who aren't over 65, but still would make it a lot easier to reopen schools. So I just think they need a little more imagination, a little more push, frankly, on the vaccine issue and on the testing issue.
All right. I agree. Bill Kristol, thanks for coming on again today. We appreciate it very, very much, as usual.
My pleasure, Charlie. And I don't know if this will help or hurt your fantastic run of more and more people listening to these podcasts.
Oh, but absolutely.
You know, I'm not a star the way some of your people are. I mean, I know I'm going to just go be sulking all day about Billy.
No, being a huge hit.
Yeah, I could email Billy Kristol and ask him to come on with you, and that would be blow up the internet, right?
Don't worry about it, Bill, because I will be tweeting out that and my special guest Billy Kristol.
Yeah, that's good. You know. That's good.
All right. Thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.